And you can see, brothers and sisters and young people, how we're preparing ourselves, can't we? We're going to really gruel ourselves through these sessions and thus become hardened soldiers ourselves in the way that David was about. And his life was rolling on, of course. I want to deal, however, with a query or a question that might be there in your mind. When David was stood there before the king, and you remember the mess that was being left on the mat as a result, I shan't mention that again. But on that particular occasion, Saul says something which on the face of it seems strange. 1 Samuel 17, and we've just read verse 57, and Saul said to him, verse 58, "Whose son art thou, thou young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of thy servant Jesse the Bethlehemite." I suggest there are two strange things there. The first is, why does Saul say, "Whose son are you?" See, it's sometimes suggested that this was the first time he'd ever set eyes upon David, and that the record, therefore, is displaced. That it was later on that he was brought in as the cunning player upon the harp, who was now renowned throughout Israel as a mighty man of valour. And therefore that bits of 1 Samuel 16 have just come inadvertently early in the record. How is it that he says to this young man, who was, as I've suggested to you, his armour bearer, who many times had been before him, who was introduced to Saul at the outset as being the son of Jesse, how is it that he now says to him, "Whose son art thou, young man?" And David's answer is the second interesting and curious thing. Well, I suspect that what is happening here is that David has been prepared by God and presented to us as a man who's got an excellent complexion, fine eyes, good bearing, good looks, a cunning harpist, a valiant, prudent man, a good speaker, a comely person. The Lord is with him, all those 1 Samuel 16 attributes, the king's armour bearer, and one who quite clearly goes backwards and forwards. I don't know if you've noticed the detail, but it's in 1 Samuel 17, and there at verse 15. "But David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem." The Revised Version says, "Now David went to and fro from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem." So it's back and forth, back and forth. One minute you're in the palace, the next minute you're with the sheep. After a while you wouldn't be sure who was bleating, whether it was a courtier, whether it was an ewe. That would be the nature of your yo-yoing relationship. And what was it destined to do? You just imagine now if we were to take one of our youngsters and suddenly move them into the White House. And there they are sitting in the Oval Room and they're chatting to the President. And the next minute you got them back doing the chores in the kitchen. Could you get them to do the chores in the kitchen? Could you? Well, of course you couldn't. They'd say, "I'm off to the Oval Room next. I've got to read up. I've got to prepare. I've got to get on the internet. I've got to do all sorts of things which prepare myself for sharpening my mind for when the President next calls for me." And yet, you see, he was a lad who was going to and fro, back and forth. It was doing something to David. And now he had suddenly been shown to be a giant slayer, a man of war. Goliath was dead, and you remember where the head was, and where the head was to go, where the sword was later to go. David was clearly going to consecrate that sword that he had taken to the Lord. He was going to take it to Nob. He was going to leave it there in the tabernacle as something that was laid up before the Lord. And the head? Well, that head was destined to go to Jerusalem. And it looks very much as though when it was eventually buried there in Jerusalem, and by this time it was only a skull, it was buried in a place which was later described as the place of the skull. Well, known to us, of course, as Golgotha. So that head was itself to become symbolic of a greater battle that was to be fought and won, of a great victory that was to be accomplished, when the enemy's head would be beneath the feet of the one who would be there upon the tree. So all those things were full of symbol and significance, but we're after the man and his characteristics. And why is it that Saul says, "Whose son art thou?" at this particular point in the sequence? Well, the answer is there to be found in verse 25 of 1 Samuel 17. See, when David edged forward to the fringe of the people who were listening to Goliath, trembling as they listened, the men of Israel said, "Have ye seen this man that is come up? Surely to defy Israel is he come up." And it shall be that the man who killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches, and will give him his daughter, and make his father's house free in Israel. So what Saul is now saying, as he looks at this lad, doubtless covered with all the marks of war, and he says to him, whose family am I marrying into? Who's about to become a free house in Israel? Actually, he hadn't got a lot to lose. A bit of bread, a flagon of wine, and the odd kid that Jesse might otherwise have sent. But now he was going to give them tax exemption, it would seem. So it followed, therefore, that he needed to know from which family David came. So that's, I think, the focus of the question now. Whose son are you? Who is your father? And now look at the response. I mean, put yourself in David's position. You are there now with all the praises of Israel around you. What would you have said when the king said to you, whose son are you? You'd have said, I'm David the giant slayer. I'm the one who killed Goliath. Look, here's the evidence. Wouldn't you? Well, I would have done anyway, which tells you a lot about the sort of person I am by nature. But you see what David says. I am the son of thy servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. That was the remarkable way that God had prepared this man. He had kept him humble. That's why he did the chores when he went back home. Because he was the same whether he was in the oval room or whether he was at the kitchen sink. He was the same in his attitude and his demeanor. And isn't that the real essence? In these difficult times when the world is about saying to us, you're a really important person. Self-esteem is all what it's about. And all the time it's trying to make us self-aware, self-conscious, able to sell ourselves to a world that's, well, not all that interested in buying. There's such a lot of supply about. But all the time the world is trying to make us something. And God is trying to make us nothing. So that we esteem one another better than ourselves. And that quite clearly is the characteristic that is now portrayed in David's immediate experience, and which turns out to be the very essence of why he was so well loved. Because the detail now flows through 1 Samuel 18 that says everybody loved David. I'm sure you've noticed the detail. You've only got to track through who it was. Well, Jonathan, for example, there in the early verses of 1 Samuel chapter 18. Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. You see, there was that affinity. Now, not very easy, of course, for Jonathan to love somebody who just clearly made himself such a popular hero. And yet, that was the situation then, that Jonathan loved him with a love that was above the love of women. And it was a lifelong love. Saul couldn't understand it. And yet, Saul himself, for all that he was a difficult and an awkward character, when he had looked upon David, he too had loved him. And there was that residual love. Even in such a black-hearted man, David was able to find some light among the dark shadows. Or when it came to the courtiers, verse 5 of 1 Samuel 18, he behaved himself wisely. Saul set him over the men of war. He was accepted in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. This lad then, this country yokel, this warrior, this unkempt man, well, he became a polished courtier and he became a soldier too. And these men of war accepted this lad who was untrained in weaponry, according to his own descriptions, who had not used armor and sword, but who now was clearly learning those skills at the same time that he was commanding a group of people. And notice how the divine process of education is proceeding apace. And Michal, Saul's daughter, she loves David too. Now David was in for a disappointment, of course, notwithstanding that he was loved, because he had been promised that it was the elder daughter, Merab, that would be given to him. And there at verse 17 of 1 Samuel 18, Saul said to David, behold, my elder daughter Merab, her will I give thee to wife, only be thou valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul said, let not mine hand be upon him, but let the hand of the Philistines be upon him. And David said unto Saul, who am I? And what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be son-in-law to the king? But it came to pass at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given unto Adriel, the Meholathite, to wife. And Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. And again Saul thinks, oh, well, one's as good as another, and here's another opportunity to snare him and to get him to fall. And there at verse 22, commune with David secretly and say, behold, the king hath delight in thee, and all his servants love thee. Now therefore be the king's son-in-law. Disappointed once in love now, so how is David to respond to this? David said, seemeth it to you a light thing to be a king's son-in-law, seeing that I am a poor man and lightly esteemed? Now, when you watch for it, you will see that characteristic right through David's life. It's like a thread, a golden thread that runs through. And it is, of course, the golden thread of humility. Here is a man who time and time again is able to say, who am I and what is my father's house? You remember I said it was an unusual thing for Acts chapter 13 to have caught the words, the son of Jesse. Nowhere town, nowhere man. And yet for David to be so describing himself at the very end of his life, there in 2 Samuel 23. So there's the pattern of a man who never loses the sense of where he has come from and knows that God has lifted him up from the dust. He has raised up David, the son of Jesse. And as such, by God's grace, he calls us and lifts us up too. Nothing and nobodies as we are, but all is of God and of the exaltation that he is pleased to show towards us because of the love that he has for us in Christ Jesus our Lord. So David has been schooled and prepared, and now, of course, he is safe. Well, now he is in greater danger than he has ever been. That's the reality of the situation, isn't it? Because as he increases, so Saul declines. He's on the upward path. The yo-yo is short-stringed now. But now look at the situation with King Saul. He's going down fast. David came to Saul, entered his service. Saul loved him greatly, and he became his armor-bearer. Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. So you see, before that situation in chapter 18, verse 2, he had been going to and fro, back and forth. But now he's settled. He's a courtier. This is his life. He can forget the past and the sheep. And Saul was very angry with Jonathan. And this saying displeased him. What more can he have but the kingdom? And Saul eyed David from that day on. You can see the green eyes now flashing out from behind the heavy lids. But Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him but had departed from Saul. And when Saul saw that he had great success, he stood in awe of him. Now Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. And when that failed, Saul was still more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. And we've only moved there from, as you can see, chapter 16, verse 21, through 18, verse 29. And compressed in those couple of chapters, you have the pattern then of a man who is on the downhill path. It goes to show, doesn't it? Let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. Here was a man who had all the potential to be a king, who had been lifted up by God, upon whom the Spirit of God had rested, albeit uncharacteristically. And he had Samuel as his tutor, and he could have been schooled in the things of God. And now this man has slumped down. And you know, it has a lot to do with what was to be found in the hand. The case with us, isn't it? The devil who finds hands for idle hands, who finds work for idle hands to do. Well, we understand that we find work for idle hands to do, and so we fill our hands with things that are for God. Indeed, that's the very meaning of consecration. It means literally to fill the hand, And so the priests, when they were offering wave and heave offerings, they bore in their hands the offerings for the Lord. They waved them or they heaved them before God. And as such, their hands were filled with service. And David, it is said of David by Abigail, that he put his life in his hands. So that's David's situation now. He offers consecrated service in precisely the same way that we should too. When we think to ourselves, oh, I've got an odd moment or two, well, there are always things that we can be doing with our hands in the service of the Lord. And what was in Saul's hand? Well, come and have a look in 1 Samuel chapter 19, and there at verse 10. There was war again. 1 Samuel 19, verse 8, rather. There was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and slew them with a great slaughter, and they fled from before him. And the evil spirit from the Lord was upon Saul as he sat in his house with his javelin in his hand. And David played with his hand. And Saul sought to smite David even to the wall with the javelin. But he slipped away out of Saul's presence, and he smote the javelin into the wall. And David fled and escaped that night. There's David, you see, in a situation where he was in peril, he was in great difficulty, and there was Saul with his javelin in his hand. And David had, well, he had in his hand that which would have pleased and encouraged. And it wasn't for the first time. Come back a chapter to 1 Samuel 18, and notice there, came to pass on the morrow that the evil spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied in the midst of the house, and David played with his hand, as at other times, and there was a javelin in Saul's hand, and Saul cast the javelin, for he said, I will smite David even to the wall with it, and David avoided out of his presence twice. There's a powerful point, isn't it? Right at the very end of that verse, David avoided out of his presence twice, says verse 11. So three times altogether, he had avoided the spear that was flung at him in enmity and jealousy. And doubtless the Lord had been there to ensure that he would not be pinned to the wall by the spear that was thrown. And there's Saul for you then, a man who had in his hand the very expression of his kingly power. There was a man who trusted in his own prowess, a man who displayed the badge of office. You remember the Philistines had control of the smithies at this time, so it was a fairly rare thing to have weaponry. When Jonathan, whose heart cleaved to David, gave him his own sword, the Hebrew is emphatic that he gave it even to David. And the reason why it was emphatic was that he was giving something that was a rare commodity. After all, the Israelites weren't beating the Philistines, they were being beaten by them. So there was no sense in which they were gathering an armament, they hadn't got them. And therefore, to have a spear was a badge of office. And when you watch for it, you see then Saul wandering through his life with his spear in his hand. I mean, it's a curious sort of thing, isn't it? It's almost cartoon-like in its depiction. Imagine the situation there. There is David playing upon the harp, and there's the music sweetly flowing through the king's palace. And there's the king, and what's he doing? He's carrying his javelin. You think, good gracious me, hasn't he got anything better to carry? And when you come to think about it, you think it is a perilous and a dangerous thing. But you can capture him much later on. Come to chapter 26. 1 Samuel 26. And this time we're far away in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul is out, and David and Abishai are tiptoeing through the camp, and Saul is asleep. And look at the record. There at verse 7 of 1 Samuel 26. So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and behold, Saul lay sleeping within the trench, and his spear stuck in the ground at his bolster. But Abner and the people lay round about him. And David, if you remember, sneaks away with the water pot and the spear. So there he is still, you see. All through his life he was walking around as though it was a walking stick. It was the pattern of a man who was relying upon the works of the flesh. And as such, well, he lives by the spear, dies by the sword. Because in the end, all that the might of his own armament could effect was his own destruction. He fell upon his own sword, remember, when his armor bearer was not prepared to dispatch him himself. And so it became clear after three occasions when David had avoided the spear, and once when Jonathan, who allied himself with David, had also had to dodge the very same missile, it became perfectly clear to David that he must flee. And you remember only too well the circumstances that attended David's flight. Saul had sought to pin him to the wall. He'd escaped. He'd gone to the house with Michal. Michal loved him. Michal was prepared to do anything to save his life. She let him down through the window. He fled away and escaped. And he made several attempts then. He wasn't a man who raced away from his responsibilities and his commitments. He was a man now who tried hard to effect reconciliation. Tied up in these narratives then are divine lessons about the way in which we ought to deal with hazard and difficulty. You might have said, mightn't you, well, speaking personally, when once that spear had come hurtling my way and I ducked and missed it and it had been left vibrating in the wall behind, I'd have been off, frankly, and somewhere far away would have been my next episode. David came back. When it comes zipping across again, he comes back a third time. When it comes racing along a third time, he decides maybe it's time for a change of scene. So he goes home. And then when David's encircled by Saul's henchmen, who have come barking like dogs and braying like animals, even then he knows that he's in danger, but he escapes through the window, and still he comes back. And you have the pattern of this man who is not easily put off by danger. Now, how do we cope now when spears and missiles come hurtling our way in our ecclesial adventures? Because that's what tends to happen with us, doesn't it? There we are playing with our hands, whatever we might be playing, and other people have got, well, different ideas of their own, and we encounter these various problems as they come to us. Do we say, well, I'm off then? We've got about 25 different ecclesias in Birmingham, you know. It's ever so easy. If you are offended in one way, I don't like the language that you use in your prayers. Whoosh! You can go to another one. Oh, they do it here too. You can find another one. And so you can move around from place to place. I see, incidentally, that I'm down as being from Solihull Ecclesia. Please don't tell my own ecclesia in Sheldon that I've joined Solihull, because they draw the wrong conclusions. But it's easy, isn't it, in a situation. Your position is different, I know, because your distances are greater. But it is easy when we are encountering opposition to run without arguing the situation through and coming to a proper resolution. And it's the same in our family lives too. Of course we can get upsets and disagreements, and we don't always see things eye to eye, and the children are a major cause of how we fall out with one another and such like, and we fall out with them as well. And disruptions can easily come, and we can easily fragment. Here's the picture of a man then, who encountering major difficulty, finds himself hanging on in there, and at last is only ready to go when he is sure that it is the Lord's will. And he was due to become an outlaw and an estranged person from the household of Israel for many years to come. But he didn't go rapidly. He was moving into isolation perforce. He had no option but to go. And you would have thought then that from the very outset, David had only a little to learn. Can we have a look at Psalm 11 and just pick up a flavour there of David's reaction to all of this? Psalm 11, and you can almost catch the bowstring of Jonathan's bow when he fired those arrows. In the Lord put I my trust. How say ye to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? For lo, the wicked bend their bow. They make ready their arrow upon the string, that they may shoot privily at the upright in heart. If the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, his eyelids try the children of men. You see, David was aware there that when he was being told, clear off, get out of the city, get away from the village, clear away from the court, that in fact this was all part of the divine providence, the divine purpose. And we get an insight, of course, into David's mind in the Psalms that were written. They serve exactly the same function that Paul's epistles do to the narrative account in the Acts. The epistles give us that insight into how Saul was thinking, and the Psalms give us the insight into how David was thinking. I said Saul, but that was a crossover there. You know I meant Paul. But take Psalm 59, for example, which is, again, quite clearly patterned upon the very episode that we've been thinking about. The headnote says that this is a psalm of David, a miktam of David. When Saul sent, and they watched the house to kill him. And there it is. There's the pattern of David feeling then all the animosity and all the enmity from his enemies that were round about. And there they are, barking like dogs in verse 6, and going round about the city, belching with their mouth. Swords are in their lips. And there too at verse 8 is his clear conviction that God will laugh at them. He will have them in derision. So you would have thought, wouldn't you, for certain sure, when he said in verse 9, for example, because of his strength will I wait upon thee, for God is my defense, that really he had very little to learn about the divine purpose. You've only got to see it there in the Psalms. David was altogether familiar, it would seem, with the God who was his strength and his fortress, the God who was his shield, the God who was his fortress and his refuge, the God who would deliver him according to his steadfast love. And yet, you see, when it came to it, David had an enormous amount to learn, and now his real preparation was beginning. These were his outlaw years. He was leaving the court, he was leaving comfort, he was off to austerity and difficulty and danger. But he never fled to the cave of Adullam straight off. Of course, he knew that terrain because it wasn't that far from Bethlehem. But when now he decided to flee, you recall from whence he went. First, he went from Gibeah of Saul, just north, just a few miles north, to Ramah. He went to Samuel. And straight away, when he went to Ramah, David encountered the encompassing power of God. Can we have a look at 1 Samuel chapter 19? Makes you wonder here whether David might not have stayed there and been kept carefully by God, for it was remarkable protection. 1 Samuel 19 and verse 18, so David fled and escaped and came to Samuel to Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and dwelt in Naoth, which appears to be a suburb of Ramah. And he was told Saul, saying, behold, David is at Naoth in Ramah. And Saul sent messengers to take David. When they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as appointed over them, the Spirit of God was upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. When he was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they prophesied likewise. And so at last, Saul came himself. And you might remember now that Saul was so overtaken himself, verse 27, that he stripped off his clothes also, and prophesied before Samuel in like manner, and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Wherefore they say, is Saul also among the prophets? You see how proverbial it was, that this man was so otherworldly from divine things, that they couldn't believe that Saul was also prophesying ecstatically in this particular way. But you'll notice that God had now provided David with a place of refuge. He had gone to the school of prophets that Samuel was instrumental in developing and building up, a great blessing that was to be there for Israel in due course, and perhaps he could have stayed there. Maybe in all the years that were to follow, David could have stayed in Ramah, Naoth, and he could have been there surrounded by and sheltered by the overseeing power of God. And he chose to move away. Well, perhaps he chose to move away because he was anxious for the prophets and what might have befallen them if circumstances had changed, as though they could be taken unawares. Perhaps it was then that he thought it would be better all round if he moved away. If so, he was making a deliberate decision to go outside the ambit of God's power in the way that it had here been manifest. Hard to say, of course, because the prophets might have prophesied, which indicated that he should go, but look where he went next. Again, it was a logical move. You see, when difficulties befall us, to whom do we go? Well, we go to God. And when we have gone to God, we go to our brothers and sisters. We find comfort and consolation and strength and succour with them. And so we ought to do, and so we do. And David's next step was to the ecclesia. Well, he went to the tabernacle, didn't he? He went just a few miles south of Ramah down to Nob. And he went to Nob clearly in a position of distress. Perhaps it tells you something about what life was like in Ramah, that in fact he came away now with neither sword nor defense, and nor did he come with food. But instead he was hot-footing it, going he knew not where. So he went to the house of God. When calamity befalls us, we come then to the house of God. And yet, of course, there was difficulty in the coming. Here in 1 Samuel chapter 20, there appears to be a difficulty that even our Lord touches upon, which on the face of it doesn't yield its meaning. Look at the position there at verse 42 of 1 Samuel chapter 20. Jonathan has sent David on his way. Go in peace, he says, for as much as we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord be between me and thee, and between my seed and thy seed forever. And he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. Then came David to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech was afraid at the meeting of David, and said unto him, why art thou alone, and no man with thee? And David lies. The king hath commanded me a business, and hath said unto me, let no man know anything of the business whereabout I send thee, and what I have commanded thee, and I have appointed my servants to such and such a place. Now therefore, what is under thy hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in mine hand, or what there is present. And the priest says, there's only the showbread, David. Now it looks as though it was the Sabbath, and the showbread was being changed on the Sabbath, but it was illegal for anybody to eat of the bread except for the priests, and David was clearly not a priest. Well, might have been a priest in anticipation, but he was not of the priestly line, and it was forbidden that David should eat of the bread. Quite clearly so. And yet, verse 6 says that the priest gave him hallowed bread, for there was no bread there but the showbread that was taken from before the Lord to put hot bread in the day when it was taken away, and Doeg the Edomite saw it all. Now, what are we to make of this occasion? Because here is an incident back in the law where an illegal act appears to occur, and yet it is an act that our Lord draws upon. Come and have a look at the record in Mark chapter 2, for instance. And when our Lord refers to this incident, he sees in it a provision of divine grace. You say to yourself, well, how can that be? Mark chapter 2. Look at verse 25. There's just been that incident about the grain being rubbed clean of the chaff and the disciples eating as they went along through the cornfield. And Jesus' response to the criticism that came from the Pharisees, verse 25 of Mark 2, he said unto them, have ye never read what David did when he had need and was an hungered, he and they that were with him, how he went into the house of God in the days of Abiathar the high priest? Now, that's very interesting in itself, because the record we read said that it was Ahimelech who was the high priest. But Jesus says, in the days of Abiathar the high priest, and did eat the showbread, which is not lawful to eat but for the priests, and gave also to them which were with him. And he said unto them, the Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. Therefore the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. And I suspect that from time to time we scratch our heads a little and we say to ourselves, I don't just follow the logic of our Lord's argument, though I'm quite sure that the logic is impeccable. But I don't just see how he draws from the narrative quite the point that he's making. Is he saying that an illegal act was justified by the occasion? Because you see, if our Lord is saying that, then our rules are never really binding rules. Because whenever we have a rule, if there's a good reason for breaking them, we break them. Because that's what happened in the days of Abiathar the high priest. Well, it's the detail back in the 1 Samuel record that makes it abundantly clear. And it doesn't come out at once. See, the scriptures wait a little for us to ponder the full significance. David goes on his way with two things. First, he is given the showbread, and then he is given the sword. Well, of all things. But there it was, he had laid it up before the Lord. There was none like it, he said. It was the sword of Goliath the Philistine. So a big sword for a big man. And David goes away now with this sword, which was identified and doubtless distinctive, and off he goes on his way into trouble. Bread and a sword. And back in Gibeah, the story is told. We don't know why Doeg the Edomite had been there before the Lord, and God could have arranged it, of course, so that Doeg wasn't there at the critical moment. We can never work out, can we, how things sometimes work out. What seems to us to be logical, if only the circumstances had been different, if only God had organized it in a different way, none of this trouble need have come. But you see, God knew that Doeg was there, and God sanctioned what happened. Yeah. God sanctioned what happened. Because now, speeding down came Saul, full of animosity, and he encountered the priest. Well, look at verse 9 of 1 Samuel 22. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, which was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him, and gave him victuals, and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Then the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests that were in Nob, and they came all of them to the king. And Saul said, Hear now, thou son of Ahitub. And he answered, Here I am, my lord. And Saul said unto him, Why have ye conspired against me, thou and the son of Jesse, in that thou hast given him bread and a sword, and hast inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as at that day? Now, do you notice there, there's voice and echo, that first of all Doeg says, not only did he give him bread and a sword, but he asked of God for him. And when Saul says, is it true that you gave him bread and sword and asked of God for him? So we've got voice and echo with relation to that question of Ahimelech asking God what he should do in these particular circumstances. What does Ahimelech say? Verse 14. Then Ahimelech answered the king and said, And who is so faithful among all thy servants as David, which is the king's son-in-law, and goeth at thy bidding, and is honourable in thine house? Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Be it far from me. Let not the king impute anything unto his servant, nor to all the house of my father, for thy servant knew nothing of all this, less or more. And the king said, Thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech, thou and all thy father's house. And so it was that Doeg the Edomite, nearly had him as Edom the Doegite, but Doeg the Edomite is the very one who is responsible for felling the priests, and almost all of them, save for two. So now let's take stock. The Lord was addressing the situation of human need in desperate circumstances, and he said that, have you not read what was done in the days of Abiathar the priest? Abiathar was the surviving priest. Jesus knew that. He deliberately ignores the fact that Ahimelech was the priest before the occasion and looks to the time after the occasion. In other words, Jesus says, don't you know what happened in the days when Abiathar became the Lord's priest? It cost the life of the man who gave the provision. But notice what happened, that when David had need, God provided for that need, despite the cost of the life of his priest. You see something now of the echoes of the lordship of the King himself, and the sense in which when we had need, and when we came seeking for bread that would satisfy our deepest need, there was a life given, and that the life of the priest, that we ourselves might eat and live. You see, there's the very pattern there of the great redeeming work of the Lord Jesus Christ. But more, there is the fact that God addresses human need. God didn't say, well, it's a safer option, David, if I provide you bread elsewhere, clear out of the camp and you'll find a dozen loaves of bread. He could easily have done that. But God says, give him the bread to eat. So God deliberately, the record tells us three times, answers the prayer of the priest, which ensures that David is given bread to eat. So it's no question of human accommodation here, in which a man changes the rules because he thinks it's right. But it is an occasion of divine grace. God judges the circumstances, sees the individual need, and decides in this instance to set the provisions of the law aside. And as such, of course, he was showing that at a later time, God would set the provisions of the law aside, so that there might then be succor and satisfaction for all those who were in need. And now David is proceeding and busying himself about his outlaw life, and is about, of course, to flee from Nob with bread and a sword, of all places, to Gath. And there in Gath now, he will find himself in desperate danger. He's no sooner stepped into the enemy camp than they say, isn't this the one of whom it was said, David has killed his thousands, Saul has killed his thousands, and David his tens of thousands? And you can hear the Philistine brain working, can't you? Tens of thousands of what were they now? Tens of thousands of Philistine! Wait a minute, we're Philistines. David's come to Gath, the very place from whence Goliath came. Isn't that the very sword that once Goliath used to wave around the camp here? And David knew he was in trouble. And so a man who had stepped with a divine provision into danger now throws himself entirely upon the Lord's provision and is redeemed. And time and again now, David was to learn and relearn the lessons. And divine providence was to be seen in so much of David's progress. There was, of course, something providential, even in what had happened at Nob. Back in 1 Samuel chapter 2, when Eli was hearing about the end of the priesthood that was to come, he was clearly told that the priesthood from his house must come to an end, that God would raise up for himself a faithful priest who should do according to what was in his heart and in his mind. I will build him a sure house. He shall go in and out before my anointed forever. Perhaps an indication there of the change from Ahimelech to Abiathar, but maybe also an indication of the fact that the one who was being prepared was himself being prepared as a priest who was to prevail before God. And yet what hard lessons David had to learn. Of course, there were immediate benefits that came from Ahimelech's death. David at once now had the priesthood, the prophets, he had Gad, his own seer, benefit from those particular circumstances, as now he was to move on as a fugitive from place to place, a man of no fixed abode. And sometimes he would go to the cave of Adullam, and there to the cave of Adullam a great multitude of people came to him, a ragtag and bobtail of people. People who were malcontent and discontented, people who hadn't paid their taxes, people who had fallen out with a variety of different circumstances. And he became, therefore, a commander-in-chief of a typical ecclesia. Well, a group of people who were themselves independently minded, who knew what they wanted to do, but had to be wielded together into a group that became a fighting force. And David, of course, was able to attract people together. And because he was the very center of their corporate life, why, he became their head and they became his body. Isn't that the pattern and the picture that confronts us in this our wilderness experience, when here we are hiding out in some stronghold or another, with the world heedless of what's going on? Aren't we, in truth, shaping ourselves to follow the pattern of the man And isn't it so that we will yield ourselves to him? Remember that occasion when David was there and the Philistines had garrisoned Bethlehem. And there he was, and he said, "Oh, for a drink of water from the well in Bethlehem." Three of his mighty men broke through the Philistine ranks. You can imagine the Philistines' amazement. Here come three of David's mighty men, straight through the defences, race to the well, down goes the bucket, up comes the water, off they go. Well, they must have been absolutely convinced that David and his men were totally and utterly crazy. But David, when he received the water from the well, well, he poured it out as a drink offering to the Lord. See, what a man it was who had welded them together into such a unity of spirit, such a oneness of purpose, and how they loved him, that they were prepared to put their life on the line. And isn't that our situation and our calling? Isn't that the very challenge which has brought us together, we outlaws who have come to find our king in a place of refuge? And is it not then that we would lay our own lives on the line for him? Well, that's precisely how it ought to be. And that's the very pattern here. And just two episodes give us a further penetrating insight into the nature of the life of this man. He was to encounter Saul, his enemy. Well, that's to say, Saul saw David as his enemy in two places. Once down in the wilderness of En-Gedi, when Saul was down there and was resting, he drifted into a cave. Come and pick the record up where Saul now encounters David, and you see a little insight in 1 Samuel 24 into David's attitude of mind and life. Verse 2 of 1 Samuel 24, "And Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel, went to seek David and his men upon the rocks of the wild goats." Here they are now down on the west side of the Dead Sea in En-Gedi. "Came to the sheepcotes by the way where was a cave. And Saul went in to cover his feet." He went in to relieve himself, as the New International Version puts it. "And David and his men remained in the sides of the cave." These are pretty big, these limestone caves. Plenty of shadows and crevices. "David and all his men were there." And now listen to the conversation. "And the men of David said unto him, Behold the day of which the Lord said unto thee, Behold, I will deliver thine enemy into thine hand, that thou mayest do to him as it shall seem good unto thee." Now remember, they had a seer, Gad was there. They had a priest, Abiathar was there. They had an ephod, which Abiathar had brought. They had plenty of means of receiving a message from the Lord. And David himself had the Spirit of God upon him. And this message had come through, that there would be a day when God would deliver his enemy into his hand, that David could do to him as it shall seem good unto thee. And you can hear the golden rule there as clear as day, can't you? As you would that men should do unto you, do ye so unto them. For this is the law and the prophets. And David now was to do what seemed good to him. And the record says that he arose and cut off the skirt of Saul's robe privily. And then his heart smote him because, well, somebody was going to have to work on that robe and sew it all back again. And so as the king is leaving the cave, unharmed but with a tattered robe, David shouts after him. What a remarkable thing it is at verse 8 that he shouts out, "My Lord the King!" When Saul looked behind him, David stooped with his face to the earth and bowed himself. And David says, "Sorry, he's done something that he shouldn't have done. I have," he said, "lifted up mine hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Moreover, my father," verse 11, "see, yea, see, the skirt of thy robe in my hand. For in that I cut off the skirt of thy robe and killed thee not, know thou and see that there is neither evil nor transgression in mine hand, and I have not sinned against thee, yet thou huntest my soul to take it." And look what he says in verse 14. "After whom is the king of Israel come out? After whom dost thou pursue? After a dead dog, after a flea." You see, in all these years of estrangement and deprivation and difficulty, and they were years, David was still able to look at himself dispassionately and say that he was nobody. I'm only a dead dog. I'm only a flea. I'm the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. I'm a nobody. But Saul was the Lord's anointed. And why, the last of these occasions that we shall consider, when in fact now, there in the wilderness of Ziph, Saul was again to be delivered into David's hand. And the record is absolutely clear about this. 1 Samuel 26. And there, why, we've come to that moment before when we saw the spear stuck in the bolster. Look what Abishai said at verse 8 of 1 Samuel 26. Then said Abishai to David, God hath delivered thine enemy into thine hand this day. Now therefore, let me smite him, I pray thee, with a spear, even to the earth, at once, and I will not smite him a second time. And David said to Abishai, destroy him not, for who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? David said furthermore, as the Lord liveth, the Lord shall smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall descend into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch forth mine hand against the Lord's anointed. But I pray thee, take thou now the spear that is at his bolster, and the cruse of water, and let us go. And so, notwithstanding that God had sent a sleep, as the record makes it clear, and that God had delivered David's enemy into his hands, something that David acknowledges within the course of this very chapter, David will not now lift his hand against the Lord's anointed. And you'll notice why. That he would not yield himself to blood guiltiness. He did not want to be terrorized for the rest of his life by a sense of guilt. And therefore he stayed his hand. And he would not sin because he knew that guilt would be the consequence. And he would not be delivered to that. And so they climb up the other side of the ravine, and presumably there was quite a steep slope that separated them, because he cries across to the sleeping camp, and the camp which had been delivered into his hand. And look what he says there at verse 18. Wherefore doth my Lord thus pursue after his servant for what I have done? Or what evil is in my hand? And there at verse 20. Now therefore, let not my blood fall to the earth before the face of the Lord. For the king of Israel is come out to seek a flea, as when one doth hunt a partridge in the mountains. You can tell there, can't you, quite a lot about David's actual sleeping conditions. Because if you've noticed, on both those occasions, fleas feature in his district description. No doubt dead dogs were occasionally very welcome additions to the pot. A partridge would be a real privilege if they were able to catch it in a pear tree or otherwise. But fleas, you see, he could at once associate with. And he thought to himself that he was nothing but a parasite, that he was nothing but someone who lived on the very edge of society, that he was a mere outlaw. And God, in all these circumstances and through all this time, and a lot of time was passing, was preparing a man. And the remarkable thing was that whilst that preparation was going on, time and time and time again, David was penning his feelings. He was painting another part of the portrait in the Psalms, and he was declaring there how he felt and how he thought and what God was doing, and the inner life of the man was what it was all about. And we then, we outlaws, we wilderness sojourners, who are here preparing for the time when God will call us to be kings and priests, when he will invite us to come, as it were, to Hebron and to Jerusalem. We then ought to be subjecting ourselves in the same way, keeping self under, constantly saying to ourselves, week by week, who am I and what is my father's house? A dead dog, a partridge in the mountains, a flea, the son of Jesse, your servant, the Bethlehemite, subjecting the self, so that at last, when the time was right, in the fullness of time, God could call him to be king, as by his grace, he will call us too, each one of us.